investors and inveterate interview consumers, welcome to Double Take and hopefully welcome back. We are the Newton Investment Management Podcast that picks the big brains of industry leaders and opinion makers on topics of import to capital allocators. I'm Rafe Lewis, head of Newton's specialist research team. But before we get into it, I just want to say, if you like what you're hearing and would like to hear more of it, well, please subscribe to the Double Take Podcast or even leave a review. Tell your friends about us. It takes a village, folks.
And I'm investigative research analyst Jack Encarnacio. Welcome, everybody. Today, we posit the question, will the rise of consumer-facing artificial intelligence, and for that matter, truly immersive virtual reality, lead humanity further into the maw of ever-present technology? Or will we as a species lean away from ubiquitous semiconductors and screens to seek a more authentic, tactile, and human-based experience?
That's right, Jack. We chose to engage in this conversation today because a big thesis among investors, both before the COVID-19 pandemic and during the lockdown phase, was that humans were tiring of screen time and seeking a more tactile, present existence, whether in our personal or professional lives. So stocks levered to the so-called experience economy, like outdoor equipment companies, recreational vehicles, and so forth, enjoyed quite a tailwind. But with the explosion of interest, excitement, and frankly, terror unleashed by the so-called metaverse and now ChatGPT and other generative AI tools, such talk has gone pretty quiet. And we wonder, has anything actually changed?
Yeah, and this isn't just an abstract rhetorical question. Scores of companies, both public and private, are banking on a counter-revolution against technology and the angst and depression it often generates among the young and old alike, feelings of loneliness. And deep inside news sites, you'll see stories such as The New Night Out, Adults Only Bouncy Houses, and Adults Are Driving Sales of the Hottest Toy on the Market, Squishmallows. And we repeatedly see studies of the deleterious effects of screen time on our collective mental and physical health.
You know, and of all the observers out there watching this debate, I would say none has probably spent as much time building the counter tech revolution thesis than best-selling business author David Sacks. So David is the author of multiple works, but most pertinent to this conversation are his two seminal works, his 2016 book, The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter, and 2022's The Future is Analog, How to Create a More Human World. David Sacks, welcome to Double Take.
Pleasure to be here.
Very good. So it's great to have you. Longtime reader, first time caller, I guess we could say. I had to get that out of the way. In The Revenge of Analog.
Yeah, you use that every time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we just say it to flatter you. We don't even put it in the final cut, yeah. David. So yes.
Do you do long time analyst, first time investor on an investor call? That would be.
We may now.
I'm going to use
long
that.
Long time longer, first time shorter. I run an activist hedge fund, so things.
I love it.
Sorry, please.
Yes, I get that sense. In Revenge of the Analog, David, you posit what I think amounts. I don't know. I think you could say it's almost an investment thesis. I mean, it boils down to technology only wins when it actually can create a more enjoyable and better experience, an enhancing experience for its human users. So perhaps we can use that as a foundation for our conversation. How did you arrive at that hypothesis way back in 2016? And why did you double down on it coming off COVID in 2022?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't, you know, I didn't seek out to write this sort of declaratory thesis. It began as an investigation into what I saw as this kind of quirky emerging trend. And that really was something I started observing back a decade before. So around 2007, this was the time that smartphones were becoming, available to consumers. The BlackBerry was sort of being put in the hands of beyond just government officials and high ranking, executives, but, you know, my friends who were in their early 20s, mid 20s were using them all for social stuff as well as for work. The iPhone would come out a year later. But at the same time as this was happening and, you know, digital streaming was beginning, downloads were sort of ubiquitous. All of a sudden you were seeing things like record stores opening and video board game cafes and board game sales were sort of booming and people were using old Polaroid cameras with new versions of the film that people had relaunched these companies. So there was this on the one hand, the sort of the news, certainly in the world of investments and capital markets, was all about digitization, Web 2.0. the emergence of social media, you know, the digital revolution in e-commerce that was going to sweep away all brick and mortar stores. And then right in front of my eyes was this countervailing trend that was really starting to trickle up in certain cities, but you could see it emerging all around the world of resurgent, growing analog goods and services and ideas. And so I wanted to look into chronicle this and also look into why it was happening. And as I did that, I saw that there was this greater thing linking these different technologies and these different services together. And that was to put it simply, people wanted it. People desired something other than the ubiquitous, fast, cheap, you know, almost free digital goods and services that was in the palm of their hand now. And they often wanted it in concert. They wanted the two of them. They wanted to be able to stream any song anywhere, but they still wanted to be able to go to a record store and buy a piece of melted plastic for $30 that had a, you know, Taylor Swift album on it. And that contradiction is really something that people had a hard time wrapping their heads around. And that's what I tried to sort of unpack. Fast forward to 2020, things are happening in the world. And right at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, I'm moved up to my mother-in-law's weekend house to get more space, you know, and I turn on the TV because there's nothing else to do. I can't leave the house. And all the pundits on CNBC and the business press and wherever are saying, you know, this is it. This is the new normal. No one's going back to school. No one's going back to an office. You know, e-commerce is going to completely jump from, I don't know, 12% to 100% of all sales. No one's ever, every brick and mortar store is done. You know, theaters, concert halls, entertainment, dead. Everything's moved to streaming. The shift that was long predicted by people like Mark Andreessen and other pundits and people who were sort of betting long on digital services and streaming services and all these other things, remote work or whatever, it had finally come and there was no returning. And I was sort of sitting there over those weeks and months and saying, well, hold on, is that the case? Is this the new normal? Because as soon as we saw measures, restrictions moving away, people began going back to restaurants, going back to stores. You know, there were lineups around the corner to get into like TJ Maxx's and record stores and bookstores and these sorts of things. Nobody was rushing to put their kids back into virtual school. I think anyone who's betting long on that is, you know, sorely mistaken. And so, you know, what were we seeing? Because all of a sudden everyone was forced into this digital future that was predicted by many, and many made long bets on. And suddenly, as soon as we had the opportunity to move away from it, many of us did. And you saw the sort of slump in the share prices of many of those companies that were the pandemic darling. One of them is the service that we're speaking on, the technological, you know, video conferencing service that we're speaking on. Other ones are services that, you know, bet huge in e-commerce that everything would make a big shift, or companies that were doing entertainment streaming and platforms or exercise streaming, right? And so it was all predicated on like, this is it. This is the prediction of the future. This is the permanent shift. It's happened. People are forced into it, but there's no going back. Oh, wait. We're mostly going back. Right. And so what did that show about not just the limits of the digital technology and the services and devices, but the deeper human desires between what we want out of a future? And that was what that second book really tries to unpack.
Well, let me try to stress test that for a second, because I pretty much subscribe to your point of view. But on the other hand, you know, I look around at these Brooklyn hipsters with their handlebar mustaches and their penny farthing old-timey bicycles, right? And I wonder if maybe this is not necessarily kind of revulsion with technology, but just good old-fashioned nostalgia. Is there some of that here?
You know, I think I don't want to dismiss nostalgia because it's a powerful force and there's nothing wrong with it. It's not a negative force unless it becomes like a complete refusal of the future, but no one's kind of taking that Ted Kaczynski Unabomber, you know, rejection of all technology. So if you're taking your prototypical young person, you know, Brooklyn hipster, paint a wide swath, or whatever city you're in, you know, riding a fix your bike or wearing like a vintage Space Jam t-shirt for $30. One is like, that's not a rejection of something new. They might be buying t-shirts from new stores, but like if someone's willing to pay, I don't know, $200 for a Grateful Dead shirt, like that's a business opportunity, right? So you can dismiss it's like, that's just nostalgic. or you're like, actually, someone's making money off this. Like there's a consumer desire here, and I may not understand that desire. What would be stupid of me would be to dismiss it. What would be smart of me is to be to understand it, right? The other thing is that there's a limit to that nostalgia. The people who are driving the sales of things like vinyl records and film cameras are younger than the technology that it's based on, right? They're, you know, my daughter wanted an Fujifilm Instax film camera, which is the sort of, you know, the biggest selling film camera in the world, right? You know, the little colorful ones, you take a picture, it comes out, it's basically
we're talking about here, yeah. Not digital, but film.
Yeah, film. It's Fuji's film's version of the Polaroid, right? It's about, you know, I don't know, 12 years old. They sell tens and tens of millions of them around the world. And that market is almost entirely driven by people who are younger than 20 years old. Kids, you know, pretty much. And they don't have a nostalgia for, you know, instant film cameras. It's not something they grew up with. They grew up with iPhones shoved in their face and tablets. So, you know, they're judging that technology based on its own merits. And I think when you look at that, you see that whether it's sales of paper books, right? The biggest market that's almost 100% paper books and print books is children. They have no interest in reading books on ebooks or on iPads. They want books in paper, right? Young tweens, which is a huge market. It's the baby boomers who are the ones that like it on the Kindle because they can take it on their vacations and they can enlarge the print and so forth, right? So we have to be careful about that nostalgia argument is a pretty thin and hollow one. And I think it's used as this kind of reflexive, dismissive thing that doesn't really get into the deeper meaning behind these trends.
David, what have you observed in your own, you know, personal enterprise regarding the split between ebooks and physical books that you sell? Obviously, you're a best-selling author, so you have a view into this. Have you seen a shift towards more hard copy sales or the opposite in the past several years?
So I published my first book in 2009. I got the publishing deal in, I guess, 06 or 07. And, you know, I think in 07 was when Amazon came out with the Kindle and the Nook reader came out shortly after that, and the Kobo, and the ubiquitous, inexpensive ebook revolution began right as I got my first publishing deal. And I was like, oh, well, there you go. Like I've been Napster. Like this is it. You know, I didn't even get to have a good run. Like I'm dead in the water. I'm toast. You know, and that first book, I, you know, got the publishing figures and it's like, yeah, we sold about, you know, 90% in paper and 10% in ebook. And I was like, oh, I guess that's going to grow by the time I do my next book. Anyway, here we are 13, 14 years later, 15 years later, 5 books later, you know, I got the latest sales figures for my last book, Features Analog, which came out in the fall. And 80% is paper book, 10% is audiobook. So that's grown, and 10% is still ebook. And that's pretty even across publishers, across the business, across different territories, right? And why is that? You know, why do paper books reign supreme? Because it is a far costlier product. You're paying twice as much for that hardcover of a new book, or even, you know, a used book. It weighs a lot. You have to cut down a bunch of trees and use a bunch of water, and you know it's carbon footprint, and the shipping is tremendous. It takes up a lot of space. Have you ever moved a bunch of books? We're packing up our house because we're doing a rental. Like schlepping books, boxes of books up to my attic today. Not something I'm looking forward to. And yet, 90% of people still prefer to read on paper. And you ask them why, and you know what the first thing they say is, "Yes,
I do not." I'm waiting pensively here.
Well, I don't smell. Me personally, right? Like they say that looking at screens before going to bed is actually bad for sleep. So I intentionally go off screens and try to do something analog.
So there's a couple logical reasons, but most people say that the touch, the smell.
Yeah.
Right. They like the touch, the smell. They like the haptic feel of a book. And most of those readers have tried ebooks. I have a Kindle that's bricked sitting in my desk. The battery is no longer charged. I tried to charge it for a vacation or something when I didn't want to bring a bunch of books. It doesn't even work anymore. And so, you know, certain technologies, even though we've invented and people sell and promote a superior replacement, the values and the characteristics of the legacy analog version still holds true. And that's the same for something like vinyl records, right? Yes, I can listen to anything I want on my streaming service. And I listen to it all the time in my car when I'm, you know, exercising or walking or whatever, in my headphones or a Bluetooth speaker. But like, there's still something wonderful and valuable to me that has me spend hundreds of dollars a year on these big, cumbersome, melted pieces of plastic and cardboard sleeves. And it's the experience of going to the store to find them. It's the conversations that come out of it. It's the way they look on my shelf. It's the sound of it, which isn't necessarily a superior sound, but it's a different sound. And that has driven a multi-billion dollar market now, which barely existed, you know, two decades ago. And so, you know, when you get into the reasons for it, I think it's, this is why where investors have a hard time wrapping their head around it, and the public, but I think, you know, especially investors, because what do investors love? They love a simplified story, right? They love a simple narrative, and the simple narrative of digital dominance is this kind of Moore's law for everything, the exponential curve, right? The digital device or the digital version of this or the software version of this will get exponentially better year over year over year. And 1 year will be 2%, the next year will be 4%, the next year will be 8%, blah, 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 blah. And after that, none of the analog things will exist. And now we added AI and it's like, oh, well, you know, we're going to triple time that. It's going to be like even more exponential. We're not even going to be walking on this earth. We're going to be brains in jars. And you're like, that's a simple story. I get that. But the reality of the world we live in is an analog world. We are analog creatures. And that means we're physical creatures that interact with all the different things in the physical world. And I say this as I'm choking on smoke from forest fires from, you know, 1,000 miles away from my home here in Toronto. And those interactions are complicated. Humans are contradictory things. I like to say, we like to think, and you know, the world of investments and the logic of capital markets, the invisible hand, the perfection of it all, right? Is like, they think, people like to think we're Dr. Spock from Star Trek. We're the logical Vulcan being that's going to do the logical thing every time. And I think if there's one thing we can learn about human history, whether it's in, you know, economics and capital markets, or whether it's just like any sort of human behavior, it's like, we're not Spock, we're Kirk. We're like emotional, irrational, wild, inventive creatures that will never do the thing that they're predicted and never do the thing that's the quote unquote right thing.
David, and can I double click on that for a second? Because to me, anyway, as a
terrible
individual
term to use in an analog conversation.
Can I drop a needle on that? I'm going to grab, there we go. Let's drop a needle on it. I'm going to grab
gonna
it with both hands.
I'm going to put a sticky note on that page.
Keep going, David. Well, no, I'm kidding.
Well, when I was a kid, you know, and your book, The Revenge of Analog, goes into this, I thought, really nicely. So, yes, I bought music in the form of vinyl records, cassettes, CDs, and I truly owned that music. It wasn't just a series of ones and zeros floating in the cloud. Same with movies. Back then, we owned VHS tapes or even DVDs, even Blu-ray, you know, later on here, right? Today, you can buy a movie on a streaming platform, but you can just lose it as soon as you let that subscription lapse, and you can go on and on and on here. And I wonder if there's something innate to humans, and maybe to capitalism, by the way, about personally actually owning something that can't be just disappeared if you change your subscription or your plan or something. What do you make of that?
I definitely think there's a truth to it. I think you see it in areas like books and records. You know, people, the value of a bookshelf in a house is has tremendous social capital. And I think people put a lot of stock in that. They put a lot of stock in records, or they put a lot of stock in art, which is why, you know, the predictions that the digital picture frame, the digital painting was going to take over the art world have not come to pass. I think when you look at things like, you know, there were predictions many years ago when the ride sharing companies were starting out. It was like, well, this is going to be end of car ownerships. No one's going to own cars. No one's buying cars anymore. It's like, people are buying cars. Right. I know someone who's doing a service of that for bikes. It's, you know, in a capitalist system, right? That ownership, property ownership, is the kind of the core of the entire thing, for better or worse. And so I think people like having that. I think this notion that, oh, we'll all have the same thing and it's great and it'll be so liberating, has its limits. And I think you see it. I use this metaphor of like, when you go into someone's house and they have art on the wall and bookcases full of stuff and you know, like a bit of a kind of crazy mess, like it's a warm, welcoming home. They're putting themselves out there with the things they've acquired and built and made, and it's individualistic, and they're expressing their individual human personality through that. And the opposite of that is like the 24-year-old junior analyst who gets a job in an investment firm or investment banking and goes out and rents like the biggest, sparsest condo they can. And you go into that condo and there's like a 50-inch plasma TV, a black leather couch, and like soy sauce packets and Bud Light and, you know, Johnny Walker Black in the fridge. And I think that's, it just goes to the core of the trends are kind of predicted on this idealized kind of version of what the future is, right? We're always predicting that it's like, oh, technology is going to drive everything. And we're going to end up in this future that's going to look like Star Trek, right? Or Star Wars. Like everything's going to be white and clean and everyone's going to be wearing uniforms and like the cars will fly and whatever. And the future actually looks always more like Blade Runner. Like it's messy and it's chunky and it's a bit crumbly, but there's culture and there's interesting things there. And I think it's, again, once you move away from that simplistic narrative of that's very binary, the future will be defined by this because this thing's growing and everything else is going to fall by the wayside. It doesn't work like that. It's always going to be a mix of these forces. And so in the investment world, it means, yes, you know, your large digital companies, the providers of these services, they're going to grow, but they're probably not going to grow in the way that things are completely predicted. They're not going to take over everything. And sometimes the things they're going to do are going to fail. Look at the pronouncements in VR and AR by, you know, two of the largest tech firms of the past couple of years. You know, it was like, this is it. The metaverse is taking over everything. And everyone's like, metaverse, long, 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 short, everything is not metaverse. And then it's like, well, that went to nothing because why? Nobody actually used this thing. And so it's that simplistic narrative that gets people into trouble every time.
What about sort of like a hybrid experience, David? Some human experiences, they're really a fusion of technology and get back to basics. I'm thinking of, you know, 100 people in a movie theater as opposed to watching a film at home or on their smartphone, or four kids playing Minecraft together on a shared server, even though they're sitting in different cities or even countries. There is sort of a shared experience there, but it is entirely digital. It is not, however, happening in isolation. Is that something you try to account for as you think about this?
I think it's all part of it, right? Like, you know, esports is one of the largest growing categories of entertainment, and a big part of it's streaming and you know, Twitch and various online forums where people watch people play esports. But like, the people also will pay money to go sit in stadiums, tens of thousands of people, to watch other people play video games, and those two things can happen in concert and they can be complementary. And the esports companies are like, well, we can make more revenue this way by charging people, you know, $30 a ticket or $100 for box seats or however much it costs to go to, I don't know, Seoul and watch, you know, the Red Bull team play World of Warcraft or whatever it is, right? And those things happen in concert. And that's why you see online-only direct-to-consumer retailers, they've all opened stores in the past decade, right? They're like, we're going to be a company that sells glasses, underwear, shoes, you know, heat pumps, whatever, direct-to-consumer. We're cutting out the middlemen. We don't need brick-and-mortar retail. And then 3 years later, there's a press release. It's like, we're opening a new experience store in the West Village and these 10 other cities. And these things can operate in concert because I think what they're realizing, and this is, again, coming up against the limits that we encountered during the pandemic when everything was only online. And so, you know, e-commerce is a great example. It's like, this is it. All commerce is moving online. It was like only a portion of it did. And people wanted to go back to stores. So what it is that old omni-channel. It's a mix. It's like people want to buy some stuff online. People want to buy some stuff in stores. Some people want to buy more stuff online. Some people want to buy more stuff in stores. Some people want to buy certain products online and certain products in stores on a Tuesday, but on a Wednesday, they buy blah, 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 blah. And again, it defies that simplistic narrative that everything will be online or online is going to die and everything will be in stores. It's like people want it all. And the companies and the markets are like, no. We need to know which one you want. We're trying to invest in the future. And so we need to know, are you going 100% e-commerce or 100% bricks? And it's like, no, we kind of want both. And they're like, oh, okay, that's double. that's double the investment we have to make in the services we're offering. How are we going to do it? It's like, I don't know, figure it out. I got to go buy a cantaloupe at the store, but I'm also ordering like electrical parts for my, you know, renovation from, you know, some distributor in Kentucky. So like,
I mean, that's, sorry, you just made a light bulb go off over my head when it comes to the work environment. And I hadn't been able to really put my finger on it. And I think you just kind of encapsulated it nicely, which is work as in the new hybrid work experience. Yes. Is really omni-channel work, I guess. So do you think that is going to be a permanent feature based on that that coding within us that we want to have it all, that we want the technology, but we also want the tactile sensual experience?
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think, one of the hardest ones to figure out. And that's why no one's figured it out. And everyone's still going crazy. And, you know, any company that's trying to institute any policy, whether it's like remote work only, or back to work, you know, 5 days a week, or, you know, 3 days on, 3 days off, 2 days, you know, with, it's like working on an oil platform. They're all struggling because we want it all. And when you talk to people, it's like people who work remote only, and I have friends who work for big tech companies and they're 100% remote, they're miserable with some of those circumstances. People who are back to work full-time 5 days a week, unless they're the managers or the owners of the company, they're miserable with some of those circumstances. And the people who are doing like some mishmash of it, they're just confused and also miserable with some of those circumstances.
So there is no Goldilocks scenario.
I think that's the big lesson here, right? We you know, technology companies, technology creators, you know, people pitching, you know, venture capitalists on a thing or pitching investors on a presentation. You know, when you're doing that kind of Kickstarter-y presentation, everything's perfect. You got the ukulele music, you got your renderings, you know, you got the video of the happy family, blah 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 blah. Everything's working out great. And then it's like, all right, now let's put this to test in the real world and real life with silly, stupid humans and their contradictory ways and their conflicting desires and their differing personalities and body sizes and cultures and demands. And it's like, oh yeah, this one solution doesn't fit everything. And I think, unfortunately, that's what digital offers in the best way, right? It's very binary. It's like Apple or Samsung, you know, like A or B, like it demands by the nature of its design, a sort of on-off solution and a very simplified solution. And that's very attractive to people because you're like, oh, with this one thing, I can do it all. I don't need these other things. And so I think that's what you're going to start seeing with the imposition of artificial intelligence on things is like, it's going to work well for some stuff, but it's not going to work well for others. And at the end of the day, we're still going to have to find some mix to meet the reality of the actual world we live in and not this theoretical one.
Well, it's been tremendous, David, to get a look at the case for analog. This has been David Sacks, author of books such as The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter, and just last year releasing The Future is Analog, How to Create a More Human World. David, we thank you so much for taking us through your thought process. It's been really interesting and great to have you on Double Take.
My pleasure.
This is a financial promotion for institutional clients only, issued by Newton Investment Management North America LLC, NIMNA, or the firm. NIMNA is a registered investment advisor with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, BNY Mellon. The firm was established in 2021, comprised of equity and multi-asset teams from an affiliate, Mellon Investments Corporation. The firm is part of the group of affiliated companies that individually or collectively provide investment advisory services under the brand Newton or Newton Investment Management. Newton currently includes NIMNA and Newton Investment Management Limited, NIM, and Newton Investment Management Japan Limited, NIMJ. Any statements of opinion constitute only current opinions of NIMNA, which are subject to change and which NIMNA does not undertake to update. This publication or any portion thereof may not be copied or distributed without prior written approval from the firm. Statements are correct as of the date of material only. This document may not be used for the purpose of an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction or in any circumstances in which such offer or solicitation is unlawful or not authorized. The information in this publication is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific investment advice or recommendations for any purchase or sale of any specific security. Some information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources that are believed to be reliable, but the information has not been independently verified by NIMNA. NIMNA makes no representations as to the accuracy or the completeness of such information. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee returns or eliminate risk in any market environment, and past performance is no indication of future performance. ESG analysis refers to a range of internal and external qualitative and quantitative research. Newton manages a variety of strategies. Whether and how ESG considerations are assessed or integrated into Newton strategies depends on the asset classes and/or the particular strategy involved, as well as the research and investment approach of each Newton firm. ESG may not be considered for each individual investment, and where ESG is considered, other attributes of an investment may outweigh ESG considerations when making investment decisions. Analysis of themes may vary depending on the type of security, investment rationale, and investment strategy. Newton will make investment decisions that are not based on themes and may conclude that other attributes of an investment outweigh the thematic structure the security has been assigned to. If distributed in the UK, EMEA, Australia, New Zealand, this podcast is issued by Newton Limited and may be deemed a financial promotion. Newton Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, 12 Endeavour Square, London, E20, 1JN, in the conduct of investment business. Registered in England, number 01371973. NIM is also registered as investment advisors with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to offer investment advisory services in the United States. If distributed in Canada, this podcast is issued by either Newton Limited, which is availing itself of the International Advisor Exemption, IAE, in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations, or NIMNA, which is availing itself of the IAE in the following Canadian provinces: Alberta, British Columbia, and Manitoba. The IAE is in compliance with the National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations.